Hello, Ambassador Bloomfield.
Hello.
So thank you for joining me this morning.
My pleasure.
It's in relation to the forum event on Thursday, the 14th of April. We're looking at dialogue and engagement with the European ministers visiting Iran right now, talking about trade and also building cooperative measures to take advantage of the sanctions that have been lifted. But how do you think we're going to benefit given that trade trends have changed? So what will be the different types of trading that we can do with Iran?
Well, that is somewhat of a mystery. In the United States, we are still getting very severe warnings from parts of the U.S. government. The Treasury Department is warning American companies that they could be in a lot of trouble if they trade with Iran, because there's a high likelihood that the entities they would be trading with are controlled by the Iranian government and would be front companies, which according to U.S. law and policy may still be subject to sanctions for issues unrelated to nuclear, such as terrorism and money laundering and human rights violations. So the American side is facing a great deal of restraint, and Congress similarly is expressing great concern about letting Iran conduct business with the U.S. dollar internationally. Whereas in Europe, there does seem to be a different perspective, having more to do with the opportunities for selling and making major contracts with Iran, whether or not this benefits the regime. So it's a different perspective.
And Congressman Ed Royce was in conversation at the forum. And just could I add that the Stimson Center addresses transnational challenges to enhance global peace and economic prosperity?
Yes. Representative Royce is the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He is one of only two Republican members of Congress, the other being Senator Corker, who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. These are the only two Republicans in office who have major portfolios in foreign affairs. So his opinions are quite important. And Chairman Royce is opposed to reintegrating Iranian banks into the global system using the U.S. dollar. And he cites the activities sponsored by the Iranian regime having to do with destabilization of neighboring countries, illicit trafficking, an alarming and unbelievably alarming rate of human rights abuses and executions, and a whole string of behaviors which are generally contrary to the norms of conduct of states in the world, and certainly adverse, considered to be very much adverse to United States interests.
Spurring the Iran economy into growth, it's at a cost of shoveling cash to a regime which even last week had hanged a total of 14 people, including women. And that's, again, going to happen continuously. But Italian Prime Minister Renzi was in Tehran making deals worth billions and not in a position to address the 14 human rights violations that happened during his visit or around that period. But can we ignore the human rights?
Well, this is a very good question, because if you recall, at the time that the Joint Comprehensive Program of Action, the nuclear agreement, was concluded by the P5 plus one last July, the U.S. administration, President Obama, Secretary of State John Kerry, made it very clear that their sole focus in the negotiation had been to contain and curb Iranian nuclear weapons potential, to stop their pathways to the bomb, as they put it, and that therefore the other issues, including human rights violations, were not considered to be factors in the negotiation. I find this a difficult argument for them to make, because the president had spoken to the UN General Assembly at the beginning of the negotiations in 2013 and had expressed the hope for a new understanding with Iran based on greater respect for each other's interests and this a much wider vision of détente or rapprochement after 36, now 37 years of estrangement between the two countries. So my own view is that the U.S. administration was pursuing a deeper understanding. And so this raises the question of whether the United States has been ignoring one of the most egregious violators of human rights in the world and ignoring the plight of the individuals who are being detained and jailed and tortured and executed in Iran, such as the ones you mentioned. And it also begs the question of whether the U.S. is being strategically unfocused about Iran's efforts to prop up Bashar al-Assad and to destabilize the constitutional process in Iraq and to essentially push out the legitimate government of Yemen and to arm non-state actors and all the other things which are so troubling. And so I do think that there is a refocusing that is needed as to what should be the appropriate approach to the behavior of the ruling regime in Iran.
A tweet that was retweeted from the Stimson Center Forum by the OIAC, and that's a place for promoting democratic change in Iran through Iranian people. And the organization is set up in the States, Iranian American community. One of the tweets that was simply, Assad has to leave, the words of the Congressman Ed Royce. And I suppose the follow-on question is that, in the article you wrote, Follow Iran's Money, in February, I think there's a subheading with winners and losers. And one of the maybe reactions or conclusions from that is that many others, this is to quote from your piece, many others do not believe Iran's clerical dictators will ever willingly cease their brutal suppression. Is it time we advanced for political transition?
Well, that is a very important and timely question. I will say this by way of preface, which is what troubles me about certain policies in the West is that the wrong people suffer. The goal of policy should be to exert leverage on the rulers in Iran. And this is one of the potential problems with sanctions as a principal policy. It does reflect a moral protest against the government, and it is a mark of dishonor for a country to be sanctioned. But it can have the effect of punishing the population for the sins, as it were, of their rulers. And similarly, when I wrote the article, I was really trying to suggest that the U.S. government owed it to the American people to tell us who all the front companies are. Give us the list. Publish the list. Don't keep it in a secret. And then if an American company tries to engage with someone who they think is an innocent Iranian to find out that the Justice Department has all of the details and now you're under arrest, I just think that this victimizes Americans. And similarly, you will now see the United States government essentially disputing with companies from the West and from perhaps Japan and Korea as a result of the lifting of international sanctions, whereas the Americans will tell other countries, you can choose between doing business in America or business in Iran. And this is a way of essentially creating tension among all of the democratic countries when, in fact, we should be exerting leverage on the regime in Tehran. I think there is one acid test that could be posed for those who claim to be advancing reform inside Iran, and that has to do with the key point in the Constitution that Ayatollah Khomeini introduced in 1979 when he combined religious devotion and political legitimacy for the first time in hundreds of years, the same thing that ISIS is going to try to do, which is to say, this velayat-e-faqih, which is the key element that makes the supreme leader essentially the embodiment of the 12th Imam the descendant of the Prophet. This needs to be changed. And if someone in Iran is willing to say, I am a reformer and I propose to remove this from the Constitution and no longer give the Supreme Leader and the Assembly of Experts, the Guardian Council, overriding power, that could be proof that they're willing to move Iran back into the modern age. But I don't see that happening, and therefore we need to have a discussion about how to promote a transition inside Iran.
Now, the main opposition party are quite vocal about this point, where they talk about maybe there are visible benefits from a trade agreement, but there are visible tensions as well, and that a population in Iran is disenfranchised by the mullahs' regime. What technical measures can be put in place to ensure Iran is complying with human rights, with reducing the amounts of people being executed, which I think figures by 2015 Amnesty death penalty figures suggest 977 people executed, and that's 82% of the global percentage in North Africa and the Middle East. Doing trade deals, is that likely to be reduced?
I don't think it is. President Rouhani came into office in mid-2013 talking about reform. He brought in the foreign minister, Zarif. Both these men speak good English, and they engaged in social media campaigns in English to charm the West. But at the same time, his justice minister is guilty of crimes against humanity from 1988. It seems to me that they are putting up two faces to the public. My own view is that the most productive way to address the behaviors of the Iran regime is to improve our gathering of information and to disseminate it more widely, both to the outside world and to break through the firewalls that the Revolutionary Guard's information command is imposing, so that the Iranian people will know not only that their government is being criticized, but they should have a much more explicit view of where the money is going, how much money the regime controls. If you look at the religious foundation underneath the Supreme Leader, the reason that so many companies in Iran are front companies and that you will get in trouble doing business with virtually anyone in Iran, if you're an American, is that the Supreme Leader and the mullahs have appropriated properties for years. The clerics have been amassing wealth, and they control the economy. Most of the major contracts that European leaders are signing with the regime are certainly with Iranian entities, where profits will flow to the clerics and to the foundations they control. It is not necessarily that they have a Western lifestyle and they're spending money the way, for example, the Communist Party of China elite is spending money, but they do use money for power. And so I do think that we need to redouble the gathering of information, and the way this was done with apartheid in South Africa, and make it crystal clear to the world what exactly the mullahs are doing in Syria, with Hezbollah, in Iraq, with the Shia militias, with the Quds Force, with the Houthis in Yemen, and with these executions. I think there's a lot of mythology which is allowed to go unchallenged, that the idea that these are all, the executed people are all drug addicts or sexual deviants, this is most certainly false. They're jailing and executing people who pose a political challenge to the regime. And it's in the year 2016, this is the kind of information that has power, but we need to make it crystal clear. Don't forget that the regimes in Tunisia and Egypt lasted for decades and were considered immovable until social media exposed the sort of lack of legitimacy and empowered the masses to demand change. Well, this happened in Iran in 2009 as well, when Ahmadinejad, the re-election was seen to be fraudulent, and it was put down by force. I believe that we could put a dossier together on the top 20 or 30 members of the regime, and every one of them would be a proper candidate for prosecution by the International Criminal Court. But this hasn't been done yet, and it should be.
And the congressman, Ed Royce, also was retweeted by the OIAC saying, the election in Iran was between hardliners and very hardliners, and that the potential opposition had been discredited even before people went to the ballot box.
Well, yes. I will tell you, Paul, that I've been a political appointee in the United States. And if you are being granted a position by a political party, they investigate very carefully to make sure that you will not bring embarrassment to the president and the White House. But in Iran, everyone who wants to run for office is investigated by the Basij, who puts together a folder and brings it to the Guardian Council to review to see if this person is loyal enough to the supreme leader or has shown any kind of deviationist tendencies. So they really are imposing a severe loyalty test to the supreme leader before anyone is allowed to run. So this is why you, in the presidential elections, you have to go back to the first presidential election in 1980 to have an open election where 100%, almost 100%, there was one candidate that was forbidden to run, Masoud Rajavi, by Khomeini. Khomeini was welcomed back to Iran from Paris, from exile, but nobody knew that he was going to impose religious dictatorship through the constitution until he came home. And at that point, people across the political spectrum were opposed to this. They did not suffer through the Shah's regime, only to see it replaced by a religious dictatorship. And so I think that there is a legitimacy deficit in Tehran, and this is what the regime is almost 100% concerned about. I interpret most of their behavior as a reaction to the weakness of their legitimacy, and mostly defensive in nature, and which makes them very dangerous.
So on one side they're buying time, but on the other side they're reacting?
Yeah, they are trying through both coercion and charm to buy time, because as I just said, most of the leaders have nowhere else to go. If they were not behind the shield of power, they could not survive as free citizens in the world, given the crimes on their personal dossier. They would not be able to walk as free men.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us from Washington there, Ambassador Broomfield.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.